One word against spiritistic manifestation has more weight at the present time than 50 words in its favor, and the large majority of people in the Western world are antagonistic to any new idea which implies that there are things about us we cannot see, influences that we cannot class, beings whom we cannot sense, by our no organs. A man who is known in his suburban villa only to his tradesmen and a few neighbors, and who would otherwise die in the obscurity his social rank and official importance entitle him to, is called a savant if he writes a book calling into question the scientific observation of a Crookes or the truthfulness and honor of a Stainton Moses. I have been told by friends that such books are useful, as they lay before us various tricks which may assist us in detecting fraud in the apparently genuine manifestations of mediums. I deny it. Most of the plausible explanations are simply efforts of the imagination, and not only do no good, but actually throw us off the scent. In my investigations, I have not been assisted by any of these armchair detectives. Nothing that they write about has tallied with what I have seen. By diverting our attention from the real evils of spiritism, they are a public nuisance. For a concrete instance of the foolish suggestions put forward by one of these ignorant know-alls, I would point to a recent work in which there is a description of how slate writing is performed by trickery. The writer says the sitter brings his own double slate, and the psychic deftly inserts a small piece of chalk, for pencil, previously prepared by being mixed with steel filings. While the slate is being held under the table or elsewhere, the psychic moves the pencil by means of a magnet concealed up his sleeve, and does it as in mirror writing. Now, mind, he does not say this is how I think it might be done, that would be foolish, but not criminal. He says this is how it is done. He states it as a fact. This statement of fact is untrue, such a thing cannot be done. Even with an electromagnet in open sight, it would be impossible to write 20 legible words. With a man sitting near you and watching you, it is not possible to write 5 legible words without detection. It is of such stuff as this that books telling us how the thing is done are written. When I dipped into them, I said to myself, is this all? If so, nothing that I have seen has been explained. But these writings pay well, they obtain for the authors a reputation for superior astuteness, and bring them into a social atmosphere above their level, for the majority of educated people are anxious not to be disturbed in their amiable doctrines of a day of judgment and a fiery material hell in store for those who do not agree with them. In saying this, I do not mean to include those bona fide conjurers who really believe the whole of spiritism is a farce, and are prepared to go to trouble and expense to prove their case, who undertake to repeat the phenomena, and who spend laborious days in practicing juggling tricks which they think, sincerely, will account for the phenomena of the séance room. Such men as Mr. William Marriott in England and Mr. David Abbott in the United States are of much use to investigators. I am referring to armchair writers, who evolve their explanations solely from their imagination. Psychics, or mediums, are, after all, only telegraph offices, by which we can, when conditions are suitable, be brought into touch with the next state of consciousness. The gift of true mediumship, like that of poetry, art and invention, is entirely independent of character. At first sight, it would appear as fitting and proper that this divine gift of seeing into the next state of being, the passive means of bringing consolation to a mourning house, of comforting the bereaved, would be bestowed only upon those who had qualified for it by leading a good life. Nothing of the sort takes place. There are many mediums of good character, but some are rogues. I remember one excellent American medium who gave me, a perfect stranger to him, some very neat tests, but he was a rogue. I know a good clairvoyant in this country who cannot speak the whole truth, in her normal state, about anything. Once she was a witness in court, and the judge said of her, as to that Mrs. Dash, I do not believe a single word she has said, and he was right. In the course of my investigations, I have witnessed most convincing mental and physical manifestations through psychics of bad moral character. We find all this in the Bible. Look at the case of Balaam, who was probably the most celebrated medium in Syria. Called upon to curse Israel, he tried to fraud and could not. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he blessed them instead. Poetry is a divine gift, yet look at the character of some of the poets. When we go to a telegraph office to send a message, we do not ask the character of the operator or the keyboard. Why, then, expect the mediums we make use of for communication with the unseen world should all be instruments of irreproachable moral character? At present we have not yet discovered what constitutes the medium. We can only say for certain that it is solely in the presence and near proximity of certain people that phenomena takes place. These people are usually abnormal, and able to put themselves at will into such a condition of passivity as to be highly sensitive to any impressions made upon them by spirits incarnate and discarnate. There are, of course, many different phases of mediumship, but all, I feel sure, will someday be proved to be subject to the same law. But what is this law? It seems to me that the following may be found to be a working hypothesis until we get a better. Man has two bodies, a natural and a spiritual, well described by that eminent psychic the Apostle Paul. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body, 1 Cor 15:44. Both of these bodies he has here now. It is not unreasonable to suppose that, in some people, the spirit body may be loosely connected with the natural, and be more free to exercise its functions than in others. Clairvoyance, clairaudience, and clairsentience are functions of the spirit body, and, by training, these gifts may be brought to the front. In the case of the ordinary man or woman, the two bodies appear to me to be very closely bound up together, so to speak, and the ever-present demands of the natural body are always to the front, the spirit body never. It is ascertained now beyond doubt that a man's spirit body can be released from the natural even in life, travel long distances and be seen by mortals. The phenomenon of materialization, the sudden birth of a simulacrum of the human body and its sudden disappearance, can only be accounted for by supposing that the form we see in the séance room derives its materiality from the medium, sitters and constituents of the atmosphere, but that the nucleus is the spirit or astral body of the medium, the whole being fashioned to meet the necessities of the spirit who wishes to occupy it. The spirit body, according to information given to me, is an extract counterpart of the natural, and is the connecting link between us and the next state. At physical death it departs to its new home. The spirit body is not necessarily spiritual in the religious sense, indeed, very often the contrary. A medium is simply the most efficient vehicle the spirit can find. Sometimes the attraction is a great supply of animal magnetism, from which the unseen operators draw for strength to perform their remarkable manifestations. Long since I came to the conclusion that genuine and fraudulent phenomena were frequently mixed at a séance, especially promiscuous séances. We may be sure of this: it is easier not to cheat, and false methods are not resorted to until power fails. Promiscuous séances are a mistake. The circle is generally composed of a number of people who do not know one another. Some come from curiosity, some to try and detect fraud, some, no doubt, from pure motives. But their vibrations do not mix harmoniously, and the result is a strain upon the medium. The best sitting everywhere have been obtained when 5 or 7 sitters, well known to one another, sit with the same psychic once or twice a week for a long time. The cure for fraud is the formation of, say, 30 men and women, bound together by a common desire to learn the truth. They should engage a medium for their meetings only, and he should receive a fixed salary. Strangers to the society should not be introduced. It is difficult, I know, to prevent a medium from giving seances outside, but his instant dismissal would be the forfeit. One condition 12 of his engagement would be that he must spend at least 4 hours a day in the open air. The seances should only be held twice a week, and each circle should be composed of not more than 7 persons. Mr. Gambier Bolton made a good attempt at the construction of 2 societies of this nature. They failed from various causes, chiefly because it was at that time impossible to secure the requisite fixed income for the medium, and consequently the latter would probably not cost each member of the society more than £10 a year, in addition to a fee of 5 shillings whenever he formed one of the circle. The rejection of evidence obtained through a medium who has once or twice previously been convicted of fraud is a mistake. Every séance should be judged on its own merits. Some of my earliest lessons in this study were obtained through sittings with F. Krug, who was afterwards exposed wandering about outside his cabinet when he was supposed to be sitting inside in trance. I was present, and have no doubt of his guilt on that occasion. But under favorable conditions in this country I have sat with this medium, and seen and heard phenomena that were undoubtedly genuine. Everything was in his favor, and there was no incentive to cheat. There is no professional medium in England who has not some time or the other been suspected of fraud, but I can assure the student who wants to inquire that the progress of his education will be very slow, if it does not actually cease, if he sits only with private psychics. Without materialization and telekinesis, the evidence for the existence of discarnate spirits is not complete. I wish to say a word about two favorite objections to the practice of spiritism. 1. Why should mediums be paid? 2. Why is darkness often necessary? Why should mediums be paid? The true question should be, why should they not be paid? Mediumship is a gift, like painting, music, poetry, oratory. If you deny the right of mediums to payment when they exercise their gift for the benefit of others, on what possible plea do you allow it to parsons, artists, singers, composers, or anybody else who is born with a tendency to some particular occupation? The fact is, there is more reason that you should pay mediums than other people. A good psychic is unfitted by the development of his gift for any other occupation, and at any moment may leave him. Why is darkness often necessary? When people ask me this, I say, my friend, are you aware that you are generated in the dark, and not only you, but every mammal what was ever born alive? Can you tell me why? When you reply to that question, I will tell you why the simulacrum of a human being cannot be generated except in the dark. The only simulacrum ever born in a good light has been the spirit body of the medium himself, and this has only been seen once or twice in the last 60 years. Light disintegrates the materials of which forms and phantoms are composed. After being formed, they may come out in partial light, and remain some time, but their gestation must take place in a cabinet, or, at any rate, in darkness. As a matter of fact, darkness admits of very good tests of the genuineness of a medium. Husk's seances are always held in pitch darkness. I will mention three good tests I obtained when sitting with that medium. When I took a friend to our rooms, I sometimes established him at then end of the oval table, 4 feet from Husk's left hand, which was held by a friend of mine. The candlestick was then put in front of him on the table, and he was asked to put a finger upon it, but not to resist its being moved. After the electric lights were switched off, and the person who did this had returned to his seat, the candle was blown out. In a few minutes I would feel the tap of a small hand on mine, and then the candlestick would be taken away from my friend and put down in the corner of the room with a clatter. One night a guest of mine arrived in our room half an hour before the time appointed for the séance. She dropped her open purse on the floor and the coins rolled about on the carpet. Mr. Gambier Bolton and I picked up all we could find, and the lady declared herself satisfied that she had recovered all that was in her purse. 20 minutes later the medium, Husk, arrived. In the middle of the séance, Joey, one of the spirit habitués of the circle, came to my friend and said, "Mrs. Arnold, here is a penny you dropped on the carpet." At a subsequent séance I asked Joey how he knew the coin belonged to Mrs. Arnold. He said, "A spirit, who was in the room when she dropped it, told me." On another occasion I was at Husk's house, and Uncle one of the controls, came, apparently in front of me, for a little chat. While he was speaking, I turned my head, first well to the left, and round to the right in order to see if I could exactly locate the position of the speaker. Uncle said to me, "Why are you turning your head about from side to side? I could adduce other instances of satisfactory tests in the dark. Where materialization is in question, it is futile for people to lay down any law as to light and darkness. In all physical phenomena the results are more quickly obtained in the dark. With very highly developed psychics, of whom there are none in Europe, a little light is allowed even during the materialization phase, as I shall presently show, some of the most extraordinary feats are performed by invisible intelligences in broad daylight. There is one medium in England through whom materializations take place who does not go into trance, as he is found talking intelligently with his neighbor when self-illuminated figures are in communication with sitters some feet off, identifying themselves and conversing. There can be no doubt about his psychic power, but I am afraid that there is also little doubt that, on several occasions, he has been detected in fraud. The best instance I have heard of combined fraud and genuine phenomena at a séance was told me some years ago by one of the most celebrated scientists in Europe. There was a young man of the company who made himself conspicuous by jeering at the objects of the meeting, and this continued even after the séance commenced. Suddenly he became silent. The séance was a successful one, many messages were given to the sitters. After the lights were lit, my informant spoke to the young skeptic, "Well, young man, how is it you became so pensive during out-sitting?" The reply was, "It was this way. When the séance began, I arranged myself in my seat so that I could tap the underside of the table with my toe without attracting suspicion, and managed to carry on, by this means, the beginning of a message. Presently I became tired of this performance, withdrew my foot and sat in the normal manner, but the message went on. This gave me a considerable scare, and I remained quiet for the rest of the sitting." Over and over again it has been noticed that the mental attitude of the sitters has a marked influence on the success of the séances. The atmospheric conditions, though they help or hinder manifestations to a large degree, are not of so much importance. The essential condition is a small, harmonious circle of people bound together by a common faith in the possibility of communication with beings in another state of consciousness, not blindly credulous, but with all their senses on the altar, and passive in their expectations of any individuality. If the medium is in a trance, he will be open to suggestion and sensitive to thoughts around. Suspicion and hostility impress him instantly, and I think it is not too much to say that, if more than half the circle are suspecting fraud, the company as a whole will get it in some form or another. Personally, I will never again sit in a circle with any pseudo-scientific investigator or avowed materialist. If a man cannot believe that our limited senses are incapable of taking in 7/8 of the wonders of nature, he is an unfit frame of mind to appreciate what is going on. No more honest man ever lived than Charles Braidlove, George Jacob Holyoake, Charles Watts, or Robert Ingersoll. They could not obtain any phenomena which satisfied them that they were in contact with another world. Braidlove once said on the platform, "I have given attention to this subject for 20 years, and have never seen a single phenomenon." Of course not. Good man as he was, the delicate manifestations of spiritism were not for such as he. The open-minded agnostic is not harmful, but the man who delivers, as he did, that nothing exists but matter cognizable to our poor senses has put on an armor which no spiritual weapon will pierce, he is invulnerable. I have long suspected that it is the spirit body which chiefly functions in the séance room. If I am right, this accounts for much skepticism. A man sees and hears many things which startle him. He is impressed, and goes home wondering what it all means. He goes to sleep wondering, wakes, has his bath and breakfast, and starts out to his business. By this time his spirit body has taken its customary back seat, his natural body has come to the front, and his objective mind causes him to believe that he has been the victim of delusion. The first séance I attended was on November 16, 1904, in a private room, a studio in Acacia Gardens, St. John's Wood. The medium was Cecil Husk, who is nearly blind. I believe he can see pictures or writing put very close to his face, but for all the ordinary of life he is helpless, and has to be attended out of doors by a member of his family. The table on this occasion was circular, and between 4 and 5 feet in diameter. There were 12 people sitting at it, including Mr. and Mrs. Husk and our host and hostess. There was also an organist at the organ, screened from view by a heavy curtain. Among the guests was the materialization medium, F. Crook. I sat directly opposite Husk, with a lady on either side of me, both of whom are gifted with psychic powers. On the table were two cards painted with luminous paint, and contained in aluminium frames with a handle of the same substance at the back, placed face downwards, a cardboard tube, a light zither, which had two phosphorized spots on the bottom of the sounding board. This enabled us to see it when it was elevated above the table. Husk went into trance. The room was pitch dark, the organist played a voluntary. In a short time lights were seen moving about over the table. I was only able to see one or two, but my psychic neighbors saw several, and the lady on my right asserted that she could see clouds very faintly illuminated. Scent was detected around us. Presently, an old, feeble voice, sounding from somewhere above and to the right of Husk, as I faced him, offered a Latin prayer, ending by the Benedict. This, I was told, was Cardinal Newman. He went round the table blessing the sitters individually, and after one final collective blessing, we hear no more of him. We then sang lead, kindly light to the accompaniment of the organ. Spirit voices, bass and tenor, joined in with great vigor from some feet above the medium's head and on both sides of it. There were, I thought, three of these voices, and they were of a very fine quality, the big room filled with sound. Then a control called Uncle made himself known by voice, going round and greeting each member of the circle. He spoke in a natural voice, but as if he had a small stone in his mouth. Suddenly, a loud bass voice, coming from above and to the left of Husk, called out, "God bless you all." This was the chief control, John King, whose name in earth life was Henry Morgan, the famous buccaneer of the time of Charles II. He greeted everybody in the circle by name except me. I had to be introduced. He told me later that he was three times governor of Jamaica, and was knighted by Charles II. John King's advent is always the prelude to the materializations, but before they took place, their zither, usually known as the fairy bells, was intelligently played by a spirit whose name I afterwards learned was Ebenezer. It rose from the table and soared above the circle, performing all the time a definite tune. Its movements could be watched by the phosphorescent spots on its underside. It rose to a height of many feet, I judged about 10, above the table, paused there a minute, then came down, and after two or three swirls over our heads, dashed to the floor. Apparently it went through the floor, for faint music could be heard underneath. After a short interval this became louder and louder, until a sudden change in the strength of the tune made us aware that it was again in the room. After a few gyrations it was laid down gently on the table. Materializations occupied about three quarters of an hour. About 15 spirits materialized. Only the face and bust were visible. These showed by one of the illuminated cards held to the side of the face by the right hand. The women's faces were swathed in a sort of bandage below the nose. One sitter, who could not recognize his relative, asked for this to be removed. The card was dropped, and presently the form reappeared without the bandage, when he identified his visitor. This time the illuminated card was not held by the handle at the back, but by two small fingers which I saw clasping the side of it. The faces were about two-thirds of life size. Three came to me. They presented themselves over the middle of the table about halfway between the medium and myself. One saluted three times with his illuminated card. I did not recognize it at first, but found out afterwards that it was Admiral T., an officer under whom I had served 19 years before. The first and third appearances were the same. I could not identify them, and it was not until some months had elapsed that I discovered it was a stranger trying to influence me to bring him into touch with a member of my family. A Hindu also appeared, either for me or my left-hand neighbor, Miss Bates. He sank down through the table. I watched him disappear until only his head was visible. The illuminated card, or slate, as it is often called, fell over it, and he was gone. One of Handel's solos was sung in a deep bass voice of great compass and power. The low notes were such as I had never heard before. The last event of the materializations was a series of wafts of air, lasting 2 or 3 minutes and closely resembling the effects of a punka, also loud scratches on the table. While 15 these scratches were going on, the voice of Uncle was heard warning the spirit not to make such a noise. He was answered by a voice from the center of the table calling Chaprao, Chaprao. Shut up, Shut up. Before he departed, Uncle came to each person in the circle, addressing them by name, to say good night. The voice sounded to me as if coming from below my knees. In all subsequent seances, the voices have all appeared to come from 1.5 to 2 feet above the table. I cannot account for this. It may have something to do with the peculiar build and supports of the round table, which we never used afterwards. During the evening, Crack's guide sister Amy was seen by clairvoyants standing behind him. She had several conversations with her medium and his neighbors. During the singing of Abide With Me, I heard a very audible goodnight and learned that it came from Amy, who was going away. She was unable to hear the singing, and the abrupt interruption was quite unintentional. When this seance was over, I was much astonished. I later attended some seances with Husk that were far more fruitful of phenomena and better in every way, but this was my first, and I felt great surprise that such manifestations should be neglected by scientific men, and that they were not better known to the public. The singing, materializations and direct voices all appeared to be quite genuine. I was not particularly affected by the spiritualistic aspect of the seance, though I saw one or two touching incidents of meeting with departed friends. The thing that disturbed me was the apparent indifference of the outside body of thinking people. The next seance I attended was in the Psychological Society's room, 67 George Street, Portman Square, on November 22, 1904, the medium again Husk, and the circle composed of 16 sitters. The manifestations were very similar to those in St. John's Wood, but I saw John King several times plainly. He materialized the face and bust life size and came to me 4 times, once 2 feet above my head. It was a strong face and very dark. I estimate the distance from the place where he materialized above my head to Husk's body in the chair in the circle to be 4 feet across. Admiral T. came to me quite distinctly and spoke a few words. It was a fair likeness. The mysterious stranger who presented himself before also came, but I was not to know his identity until later. Cardinal Newman, as before, gave the Gloria in Excelsis, and pronounced the Benedictine in the Italian style, as if there were an H after C. This I found, on inquiry, was his custom in life. 2 or 3 materialized heads and busts presented themselves to each sitter, who, as a rule, identified them as departed friends. A lady sitting next to me identified her son, and when the illuminated card, slate, was dropped, had a conversation with him. At the end of the seance, there was a chant of Greek precepts that we did not hear on the previous occasion. It was very melodious and effective. On November 29, 1904, I sat with Husk again in the same room with 15 others in the circle, including, as on 2 previous occasions, the medium and his wife. The first manifestation was a series of cold wafts over the backs of our hands, which were connected to our neighbors all round the table. The cardinal came as on previous occasions, bestowing his blessing collectively and individually. On arriving and departing, he exhibited a bright cross in front of each person. We sang lead, kindly light as usual, 1 deep bass voice and 2 tenors joining in. The affine voice sang part of a solo, rocked in the cradle of the deep. It collapsed, apparently through want of strength, before the second verse was finished. I said, "That is Foley." Immediately 3 taps came on the table in front of me, indicating assent. John King made himself known with a stentorian "God bless you all," and greeted each sitter individually. His deputy, Uncle, always comes at the beginning of the seances, and goes round to each member of the circle. The materializations began soon after John arrived. He always presents himself first, and is never satisfied until each sitter has seen him clearly. About 35 or 40 spirits shewed themselves in form. They were all smaller than life size, but most of them were recognized. The face of a woman came to me, the lower half of the face swathed in a bandage. I said, "Are you a relative?" Emphatic bow of the head. "Are you my dash?" Mentioned a relative, no movement. Then the head swerved suddenly to the left. I knew it by the profile and called out the relationship. It collapsed and 3 knocks came on the table directly in front of me, indicating assent. It was Iola. There's Iva, or as we were accustomed to call it, the fairy bells, performed various gyrations round the table over the heads of the sitters, playing a regular tune, before and after the materializations. The spirit that works it is known as Ebenezer.